Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More now on the threat of the tariffs to be charged on imports coming from Mexico, our biggest trading partner, to be paid by U.S. importers on everything from avocados to cars if Mexico doesn't stop asylum seekers from arriving at the U.S. border. President Trump says a 5% tariff would take effect a week from today and rise by 5 points per month through October. Let me replay the clip of White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney from Meet the Press yesterday about the three things the president wants Mexico to do.
Number one, they can secure their southern border. Keep in mind what's lost in the discussion about this is that most of the people coming across, I think on average about 4,500 people came across last night. That compares to 700 people a day just 2 years ago. Most of those folks are not Mexican. They are Guatemalans. They are Hondurans. And that border along the southern Mexico needs to be secured. It's much easier to secure that border than it is our border because it's so much shorter. It's about quarter the length. They could do that. The Mexican government can crack down on their domestic terrorist organizations, their crime organizations. Right now in Mexico, there's roughly 100,000 people trying to move up to the U.S. border. They don't do that by themselves. They do that with the cooperation of these crime groups. The Mexicans can do more there. And lastly, they can make Mexico a safe third country. Keep in mind, if you leave a country, say you leave El Salvador, you say, I'm seeking asylum, the law says you're supposed to seek asylum in the first safe country in which you arrive. Mexico is safe. The Mexican government can address this so that...
And they have been taking...
They'd be taking more,
yeah.
But not enough.
Mick Mulvaney, acting White House Chief of Staff on Meet the Press yesterday. And with me now on that and other Monday politics are two Washington Post correspondents in Mexico City, Mary Beth Sheridan, who covers Mexico and Central America, and here in New York, Philip Bump, who covers national politics. Philip and Mary Beth, good morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Philip, I think we heard from Senator Cotton there the position of many Republicans on the tariffs. They want Mexico to do more to stop the asylum seekers, but they don't like the economic implications of tariffs. How would you put his answer in context of the larger congressional response?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the Republican Party in general is in a tough position on this, in part because they recognize that there's a lot of political value in standing with the president, with their base. But at the same time, recognizing that this policy, more so than a lot of the president's policies, actually have a direct negative effect on their constituents. This, if implemented, which of course isn't a certainty, would have a dramatic effect on the price of a lot of things. I mean, people point to avocados with some regularity, in part because of how many, you know, the percentage of avocados that we get from Mexico. But there will be a lot of ramifications. As you said, this is our largest trading partner. A lot of things would be affected by this. And as has been pointed out repeatedly in the context primarily of the Chinese tariffs, these tariffs are mostly borne by American consumers. And so this is essentially a tax increase on Americans, which Republicans obviously spent a lot of time saying that this was something that was antithetical to their political positions, and now they're trying to balance that with support for a president that their base likes.
Mary Beth, you wrote that the Mexican government has gone into diplomatic overdrive to head off these tariffs. If it's U.S. importers and consumers who actually pay the higher prices on everything from avocados to cars, as Philip was just explaining, what are they so worried about in Mexico?
Well, certainly they're worried about anything that would reduce the amount of exports to the United States. Mexico is a very export-dependent economy, and 80% of everything they export goes to the United States, so they are really sensitive to any measures. And if you can imagine, if these tariffs continue as laid out and get to 25%, that certainly could affect the extent to which companies and people in the U.S. Will want or buy imported Mexican goods.
The three demands that we heard in the Mick Mulvaney clip, and Senator Cotton summarized them pretty much the same way: Mexico closing its southern border, Mexico cracking down on criminal organizations that help the really large migrant flow move north through the country, and declaring Mexico itself to be the destination for the migrants from their south because it's the first safe country that they come through. On the first one, how porous is the Mexico-Guatemala border and why?
Well, it's pretty porous. So there is a river down there, there's jungle. It's quite a geographically complex border, and it's one that Mexico hasn't really emphasized as much in the past. It didn't have a lot of problems in terms of people migrating into Mexico and staying in Mexico, and the Central American migrant phenomenon has just grown so quickly in the last year, and I think Mexico has not really caught up to that.
On Mulvaney's reason number three, Mexico itself as the safe haven, many Americans might in fact wonder if all these Central Americans are really just fleeing danger and not looking for reasons to come to the United States for more ordinary immigration purposes. Why don't they stop when they get to Mexico, which is a safe haven and they already speak the language?
So I think there's a lot of reasons. In many cases, those migrants have relatives in the United States and they want to join those relatives. I think that they obviously view their economic prospects in many cases as better in the United States. The minimum wage in Mexico is very low. It's actually lower than it is in some Central American countries. And often migrants will say, well, they can survive in Mexico, but they can't send money back to their families. They won't earn enough. So that's a concern. And in some cases, the migrants do feel that Mexico is dangerous, and Mexico is a very violent country. So that's you know, not a concern to be dismissed either.
Listeners, we invite your questions or comments on the threat of big tariffs on Mexico if they don't do more to stop the flow of migrants from Central America, or if you want to follow up on the recorded Tom Cotton interview. Any Mexicans or Mexican-Americans listening who would have an opinion or a question, you can also comment on yesterday's election results that gave the populist president there, Manuel López Obrador, even more power. Mexican-Americans listening right now, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or anyone in any business here in the U.S. that wants to say what the effect of the tariffs might be on your business or your customers. You can help us report the story in that way. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, with Washington Post correspondents Mary Beth Sheridan in Mexico City and national politics correspondent Philip Bump here in New York. Philip, let me replay the clip that we aired earlier of New York City Congressman Gerald Nadler from Friday's show when he said tariffs are up to Congress, not the president. Here it is.
To try to blame the Mexican government and to use tariff laws, tariffs are taxes on Americans. And by the way, taxes should be levied by Congress.
Taxes should be levied by Congress. So is there a constitutional separation of powers issue that Republicans are signing on to as well, or only Democrats like Nadler?
No, that's a fair point. We've seen this raised by some conservatives, primarily in the media, that it is the role of the Congress to actually levy tariffs. And so to get around that, what the administration is doing is they're actually using their national emergency declaration that the president made earlier this year, and they're going to be, the president has essentially announced that he's going to be using a specific subset of the national emergency powers that he has in order to levy these tariffs. As such, that allows him to get around, for example, as he was negotiating the USMCA, this new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico, he actually had a side letter with Mexico saying that they weren't going to impose any tariffs on the automotive industry in particular. That side letter is negated here because of the law that they're using in order to do this.
So that's really interesting. The president's rationale is that under the state of emergency declaration that he has issued with respect to the border, he has granted himself emergency tariffs authority as well. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, so there's a law called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEPA, and that's been used in the past when there have been national emergencies to, say, ban any imports from a particular country. We've seen this happen in the past. There is actually one of the longest-standing national emergencies, which deals with Iran, has some powers under IEPA that have been applied. That's the law, according to a trade lawyer that I spoke with on Friday, that's being applied here that allows them to move outside of Congress and taking this action.
And, of course, there's debate over whether what's happening at the border really qualifies as a national emergency, but this is a good example of the power of the presidency if a president chooses to use it that way, right? He can unilaterally declare a state of emergency, and that's not just a public relations exclamation point. It comes with an actual unbalancing of the separation of powers with Congress.
Well, this has been one of the the longstanding questions about the use of the national emergency's powers by the president and by this president in particular, as he wound up considering whether or not he's going to do this as it applied to the border. We heard this a lot. This power is too broad for a president. And in the past, people sort of relied on the president not taking actions just simply by virtue of the president recognizing that the imbalance of powers was an important thing to respect. Once you have a president that is less likely to show that sort of respect for the balance of powers, things get pretty problematic. And I think we're seeing an instance of that with this national emergency declaration at times.
Let me take a phone call. Ernest in Orange. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ernest.
Hi. How are you doing, Brian?
Thank you. Pretty good.
The reason he didn't close the borders is because it would have killed our auto industry. Now we've got a situation where the taxes to stop the immigrants coming. First, it was going to be a build a wall and Mexico was going to pay for it. Now we find out that we've got to pay for it. Now he's trying to stop the immigrants coming. When we destabilize countries, something has got to happen. And we're going around the world destabilizing countries. I'll take the answer offline.
Ernest, thank you very much. Philip, I'll go to you with the first part of his statement that the president didn't close the border. And remember that was one of the other threats that Trump came out with, right, with respect to his, you know, unhappiness with all these migrants coming from Central America. He was just going to close the border with Mexico altogether for legal, illegal, anything.
Right.
And as the caller says, he didn't follow through with it, largely because he didn't want to cripple the auto industry. So how do you see that, what turned out to be empty threat, in the context of this?
Well, I think that the folks with whom I've spoken have suggested that by implementing these tariffs, it will have close to the same effect as shutting down the border. And the reason why is because goods which normally were able to pass across the border with, you know, obviously being checked for a variety of things, including efforts to smuggle, instead, now there has to actually be a calculus of what tariffs will apply to them, right? That's going to slow down what's going on at the border. And the border has already been slowed, as I'm sure Mary Beth can attest. What's happening at the border is that because resources have been shifted away from border checkpoints to try and control the inflow of migrants, things are already slower there. So the odds are good that things are going to grind nearly to a halt, according to people with whom I've spoken, because of the implementation of these tariffs. And in fact, that may happen sooner than that, because there are going to be a lot of manufacturers in Mexico which are pushing stuff to the border now before these tariffs go into effect on June 10th in order to get them across the border without the tariffs applied.
Mary Beth Sheridan in Mexico City, same question.
Well, I think that you are looking at a very complex situation right now. And I think one of the things that's important to underline is the difference between how Mexico and the U.S. are looking at the issue of Central American migration. Mexico is taking a very long view. They've been campaigning basically for this sort of Marshall Plan for Central America. They want to be able to encourage the United States and other countries to join them in investing in different kinds of job creation opportunities and so on. And I think the U.S. is saying, well, the U.S., first of all, is not showing a whole lot of favor for that idea, but the U.S. feels there's an urgent need to act now, and they want Mexico to do what it can. But it's a very tricky situation because Mexico's own migration authorities are kind of limited in size. Immigration in the past was something that involved Mexicans moving to the U.S., and of course Mexico didn't stop its own people. So now they're grappling with this question. You know, they don't have much infrastructure. They don't have many immigration agents. So the Mexican argument is they're doing as much as they can. They've certainly increased deportations and detentions, but you know, they've got a limited capacity to stop people.
Clark in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Clark.
How you doing there? What I see is that all this with Trump is just a misdirection of what the real problem is. The real problem is that those countries down in South America and Mexico, too, do not have the rule of law. Their people are running away because of the things, the corruption and the lack of jobs and whatnot that's happening in their country. Solve the problem. Don't create a problem by claim by blaming immigrants for trying to run away, for trying to get away to a better life, when you have that statue out in the harbor there, sending your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, deal with the real problem.
Clark, thank you very much. I'm going to go from Clark in Harlem to Steve in Harlem. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, Brian? I just want to say, Hope, I'm like always your national treasure. Huge fan. I just love the show and the segment.
Thank you.
I'm calling as African American, who's had family who's been in this country since 1760, free and unfree. And I'm a progressive. I'm college educated. Morehouse College is that. I come from family, college educated, and I just say this to say, I found myself agreeing with Senator Cotton in some aspects, even though I understand that each side is playing the field. Senator Cotton is right. Why would we, as American citizens, go out and get 50,000 advanced, or they say extremely educated immigrants, to be doctors, architects, and lawyers, when progressives and Democrats in general have been saying for years, we need to invest in our youth here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying, like, so when you hear, like, I'm saying African-Americans, if you speak to a plural, mm-hmm. African-Americans, and if you were here, like, there's been a lack of investment from kids in Harlem, Compton, Atlanta, the kids in Appalachia, Kansas, Montana, just across the country. Black, brown, white. We should be investing the youth here. There's Caribbean countries who help their kids get the medical degrees. And then they come here and they become the doctors. And it's really hard to tell a Trump supporter or a grandma in Harlem who's African American and been voting for the DNC, how come her kid or grandkid, they can't get a job, and then she goes to get her prescription filled, or she goes to her doctor's office and she sees all these new young doctors who are coming over on visas. And now we're not saying, like, again, like, people are not assimilating and that's cool and that's great, but it's hard to argue the fact that we should be granting these privileges and these dreamers and all this greatness where this kid here who's still dreaming. And that's from Appalachia to Harlem, from Compton to Montana. And again, the low skill of this labor, we don't need that, because we should be paying Americans across this country a fair wage. The middle class has been decimated. The working class has been decimated. The unions have been decimated. And it's because both sides have been playing the field as they were sitting on their hands. And I can see the difference between African Americans and Trump voters is, we look at Donald Trump and we can still see, like, oh yeah, of course, that's the prison industry complex. And of course, like, you know, like, stop and frisk. And all this great, all this stuff that hurts African Americans and illegal Hispanics, like Puerto Ricans and the Chicanos who have been here illegally for hundreds of years as well. But again, like, those communities, the kids aren't getting a shot either because of illegal immigration. And again, if we're saying that we can't fund free education, that we can't fund healthcare, we can't get clean water in Flint, and we still saying that, oh, we should let more people in the country, and we should be clean.
I understand your point.
Water to this country and to that country, it's hard to tell that to the American citizen, Brian. It's really hard.
Steve, I'm gonna go and get a response, but I really appreciate the thought. I understand what you're saying, and please call us again, okay?
And Brian, I just want to say too, please just too, when you ask Americans to come onto your show to speak, you have to give. You have to know the lineage, because again, I love when you have on a brother from New York Times, Roland Martin, as well. But their perspective on immigration is a little bit.
I understand. You're saying recent immigrants, recent immigrants, as opposed to descendants of slaves.
Exactly. You need to get Yvette Carnell, and like Michelle Obama is not the same as Roland Martin. Like, it's people of color, but like Michelle Obama,
I get you.
Robinson.
Uh-huh.
Has history in this country of enslavement.
I totally get it, and we definitely do try to do that, represent that range. Steve, do call us again as we continue with Philip Bump, Washington Post correspondent in New York covering national politics, and Mary Beth Sheridan, Washington Post correspondent in Mexico City covering Mexico and Central America. And Philip, Stephen makes a deep point and a complex argument that's really beyond the scope of this segment, but one that we should come back to and do its own segment on, sort of the obligation of this country to help bring up the income and wealth status of African Americans who've been descendants of slaves before we allow a lot of new generations of immigrants into the country. Where it gets complicated is it's not necessarily a zero-sum game, and immigration doesn't necessarily make it harder to do that, right. But that's where he's coming from.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, I think that there's a choice presented there that I think a lot of particularly folks on the left would disagree with, that you either can provide sufficient funding for programs which support American citizens, or you can deal with the recent immigrants, which I don't know is necessarily a choice that needs to be made. I mean, I think that a lot of folks on the left would argue that both can be done, and the issue is really in how much is being done for Americans as it stands right now. You know, I mean, I think that part of this, too, is and polling has shown this, there's a broad misunderstanding of the composition of immigrants that are in the country illegally. It is, at this point, the new people who are arriving in the country and who are staying here illegally, most of them are overstaying visas. A lot of them have arrived not by crossing the border from Mexico, but instead by flying into the United States on valid tourist visas and then not leaving on time. If you look at the composition of who constitutes that group at this point in time, there are actually more Asian people who are recently added to the pool of immigrants who are here illegally than there are people who are of Hispanic or at least of Mexican heritage. So it's not necessarily the picture that we have of immigration is itself not necessarily always matching what the current state of play is. And I think that because of this, and it certainly is the case too, that opponents of immigration try and foster this idea that we need to take care of Americans before we deal with these other folks. But I think that, you know, one of the callers made this great point about the Statue of Liberty and how America has over time actually incorporated immigrants into what's happening in America in building America into what it is today, that I think is a bit of historic, an historic data point that I think is worth remembering too.
And the caller also, you know, was candid about his conflictedness, because on the one hand, Trump will do everything, as the caller sees it, that's against the interest of African Americans, while at the same time doing this one thing that the caller thinks might be economically justified, which is to limit further mass immigration until descendants of slaves are brought up. But that's, as I say, a deeper question for its own segment on another day. Mary Beth Sheridan in Mexico City, let me go back to you on this meeting that they've scheduled for Wednesday between Mexico's foreign minister and Secretary of State Pompeo. Do you have a sense of the framework that they might work out to stop these tariffs from actually happening, or a realistic set of compromises that either side might be willing to make?
So the Mexicans have projected a tone of conciliation and suggesting this can be worked out through negotiation. They've been very active, have sent several cabinet ministers up to Washington. And I imagine they're meeting with people like industry leaders in the U.S. and others who also are opposed to these tariffs. Mexico has indicated it's willing to do more on migration. They have specifically said they do not envision accepting a third safe country agreement, which would sort of require asylum seekers to stop in Mexico, basically, right? They've indicated they're not in favor of that, but they haven't said anything publicly, really, about the issue of strengthening the southern border and doing more to stop the smugglers, other than to point out that they've increased quite significantly the number of deportations this year. So they're doing things, but I sense that there are areas there where the Mexicans would be willing to commit to more. So I think they are hoping very much they can reach some sort of agreement.
So you talk about diplomatic conciliation. You wrote in your article the other day that in response to this tariffs threat that Trump suddenly came out with on Thursday, Mexico went into diplomatic overdrive, as you put it, which says to me that this is freaking them out. Is this freaking them out?
It's freaking them out, yes. So we have a new leftist president in Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's tried very much to have a cordial relationship with Trump. And I think one of the things he realizes is that he's got a very ambitious domestic agenda. He wants to shift more resources to the poor. He wants to build up the state-owned oil industry and so on. And what he doesn't want is anything that would disrupt or derail his agenda. He doesn't want a big fight with the United States. And I think he understands an economic crisis would certainly make it tough for him to carry out his plans and would, you know, would make him quite unpopular. So they're eager to reach some sort of settlement.
Right. And your line is breaking up. We'll see if we can get through these last couple of minutes of the segment, or I'll just go back to Philip. But Mary Beth, you know, Donald Trump is Mr. Tough Guy on the border. He's vilifying the migrants. He's separating children from their parents. Cotton, in the interview, said from their alleged parents. He's putting down the unwelcome mat. Why is the number of people making this risky journey more now than 2 years ago under these circumstances?
You know, I think there's a lot of reasons, and they range from climate change and areas where farmers can't successfully grow crops anymore, so they're literally going hungry, to what seems to be smuggling networks that have gotten more and more efficient, more and more, they've lowered the prices, they've found ways to move people through the country more quickly. So in a sense, people view, you know, their prospects of getting to the border is pretty good. They're willing to do it. So, you know, and the smugglers, of course, will always be telling them things like, oh, Trump is about to crack down, you better go now. So they use some of the rhetoric, actually in the opposite. Mm-hmm.
Well, what about the smugglers? Because that was the other thing in the clip we played of White House acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, that he said they're demanding from Mexico that we haven't touched on, a crackdown on the criminal gangs who the White House says is helping the migrants come north. Now, the president has previously painted the gangs as predators on the migrants. How central and how complex is that relationship? Are they predators and enablers?
Oh, I would say yes. And it is a very complex network. I think there's a sense from the experts I've talked to that these are not sort of a handful of giant cartels the way the drug business traditionally worked. They're smaller groups. Admittedly, many of them do work with the cartels, but they're smaller and more nimble. I think, again, you know, Mexico's Migration Institute pretty small, and justice system is fairly weak, so its ability to go after these groups is somewhat limited. You know, and Mexico is in the midst of firing a lot of people from its Migration Institute for corruption. It's traditionally been very corrupt, so it sort of has limited capacity to launch, you know, ambitious investigations and really shut down these networks.
And Mary Beth, last thing for you. You also report today in the Washington Post on elections in Mexico yesterday that have left their populist president, Manuel López Obrador, with the biggest mandate of any president in Mexico since the 1990s. And yet, though Obrador ran as more of an anti-Trump firebrand than his predecessor, who was seen as too much of a doormat, you're describing Obrador as not taking a confrontational kind of resistance-oriented approach to Trump. How does that make sense?
So it's really interesting. When López Obrador was on the campaign trail, I'm talking about a year and a half ago or so, 2 years ago maybe, I mean, he actually came out with a book called Listen Up, Trump, right?
Right.
And it was a bunch of essays about, you know, how wonderful, particularly Mexican migrants, you know, how decent they were, et cetera, how they deserve dignity. And as his election approached, it became clear he was going to win a big victory, and he really kind of toned it down. And again, I would just say that he is pragmatic in certain aspects, and he understands the economic relationship with the U.S. is enormously important. And his predecessor, even though he, you know, really tried to reach out to Trump and make gestures and so on, there are big fights between Mexico and the U.S. And I think López Obrador has decided that that's just not going to be helpful, and he wants as much as possible to just limit any of these controversies. He's very persuasive and good at public communications. He's constantly telling Mexicans that this is just U.S. internal politics, and he's trying to tamp down sort of a nationalist backlash. So it's been quite interesting.
Populist pragmatist. So Philip Bump, last question in our last minute. From this country's political standpoint, as we head into 2020, how much does the president want the migrant issue to ease so he can claim a victory and not look ineffectual on one of his top issues? And how much does he want it to remain unsolved so he can run on it?
No, it's a great question. I mean, I think that there's a lot of that sort of balancing that's not really clear from the outside how much where the president is hoping the scales land. I mean, from the one standpoint, yes, I mean, he would like to be able to say that he solved the migrant crisis. But on the other standpoint, he has claimed success at various points, regardless of what's happening at the border. He, for example, when he first took office, claimed success because the number of apprehensions was way down. Then he claimed success because the apprehensions were so high, and it was a sign that people were doing a good job policing the border, right? So he tends to try and have it both ways regardless. I think this issue of the tariffs is particularly interesting because there's also a scenario in which these tariffs are applied, there's an economic pain that is applied, and then they're lifted in the middle of 2020, and then all of a sudden the price of avocados goes down, the price of all these other things go down, and people are very happy about that, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of complexity to all of the various parts of this. I'm not sure the extent to which the White House is actually playing out those various scenarios, but, you know, I think it is certainly the case that regardless of what happens, President Trump is well attuned to the idea of trying to take credit for the good things and not so much the bad things.
In Mexico City, Mary Beth Sheridan, covering Mexico and Central America for The Washington Post, and here in the States, Philip Bump, who covers U.S. national politics. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.